Hello there, and welcome along to this week's edition of The Front Page, the Racing Post show that runs you through all the biggest stories of the previous week and tells you what they mean for the future of racing. I'm your host, Maddie Playell, in the chair today. I'm lucky enough to be joined by our West Country correspondent, James Stevens, is with me in the studio. James, West Country weekend upcoming. How are things?
It is, yeah, very much looking forward to it. They say it's the week of a race which stops a nation, and looking forward to the Badger beers. What can I say? But cracking meeting. It's going to be weird this week because there's been so little rain around. I don't know what the field sizes are going to be, not least for this weekend, but also Cheltenham the week after. But if we get some rain, get some runners, then all will be good. But wait and see what we get.
And our Irish editor, Richie Forrestal's also joined us on the line. Richie, you had last week off, but I'm sure that you couldn't escape City of Troy. How have things been going?
Yeah, good. Thanks, Maddie. Yeah, spent a bit of time off, half term here with the kids. So was busy with them all week. But yes, tuned into a busy weekend's race. And we obviously had Down Royal as well, which was great to see some good National Hunt horses back, and the big night in Delmar.
Absolutely. Now, a reminder of our Members Club subscription service. If you'd like to hear more about it, listen to this. It's been an impactful week in racing, with Rachel Reeves announcing her first budget and City of Troy's Breeders' Cup Classic win going up in smoke almost exactly when the gates opened. But we're going to start on a sombre note with the passing of the beloved racing journalist and broadcaster Alistair Downe. Only a week after the Cheltenham press room was named after him, we sadly learnt of his passing, and he was a gargantuan figure for all of us in the racing world, an incredibly admired, special man for his work on the page and in broadcasting circles. He was one of the most beloved racing writers of modern times, really, a five-time winner of the Racing Writer of the Year Award, and later a broadcaster on Channel 4 Racing. Many people will remember him from those skirmishes with John Frankham, etc., on that programme. There's been an outpouring of love among colleagues here at the Racing Post, of racing figures, jockeys, trainers, owners, all week, all deeply saddened by the loss of Alistair, who was not only a shining journalist, but also just an incredibly fun and lovable character. I've been reflecting on this week, and actually I wasn't lucky enough to meet Alistair, unlike James and Richie, so we'll hear some of their tributes in just a moment. But when I first joined racing, I didn't come from a racing background and wasn't really familiar with anyone in racing at all. But I loved Alistair's work because it was so moving and so powerful and really made me feel understood. And I think a lot of people can relate to that, in the way that Alistair used to write was so beautiful. He almost made you feel as if you were sat right next to him, enjoying the experience with him. So good at depicting those emotions that this great sport gives us, both the best, the highs and the lows. And that extended from the page in the Racing Post, before that the Sporting Life, to, as I mentioned previously, the Channel 4 Racing team. Mornings were spent watching the morning line. Used to love waking up with Alistair on Channel 4. Felt like you were in a pub chatting with some of your best friends. And I think there's no better accolade than that when you are a lover of the sport. And that was something that was so clearly shone through in all of Alistair's work, in that he really was an ambassador for racing, even if he didn't intend to be. His enthusiasm and just absolute pure understanding of what the sport was about just endeared him to everyone. As a professional, as a writer, he was unmatched. He stood alone in what he could achieve with his words, and he will be greatly missed by, I'm sure, family, friends, everyone here at the Racing Post, and his death will be felt for a long, long time. Richie, you knew Alistair, you worked with him for a couple of years. What were your fondest memories of him?
Yeah, well, for someone who hasn't met him, Maddie, you paid him a fitting tribute, fair play. I actually would have first met him about 25 years ago when I was working for Henry Daly. And he was good friends with Henry, and remained so, as far as I'm aware, right up to the end. And when we would be doing evening stables, kind of once a week or so, maybe once a fortnight, Alistair used to come around with Henry to watch, to see all the horses at evening stables. And that would have been my first kind of personal interaction with him. And it's something that struck me about him at the time, and has continued to do so throughout any relationship I would have had with him, was how he made an effort, you know, to greet you and by name and give you a few minutes of his time and so on. You know, he would have been a big, as you say, a big figure. He was a doyen of the broadcasting world and the press room. But he made that effort and made that time. And same, you know, as a journalist, I know I remember him getting in touch with me from time to time. He'd have gone out of his way to get your number or your email address, and he'd contact you to you know, commend you on a piece or whatever, or just to have a rant or a moan about something that's after happening. Excuse me. So he, you know, he's a big loss. I mean, you spoke about his time as a broadcaster. You know, the rapport that he had with the likes of Frankham and Jim McGrath and McCurry and all those guys on Channel 4. And we, you know, we see now the clips that pop up on social media. It really was a golden era of broadcasting for racing. And he was central to that. But obviously, you know, his writing was so powerful. He wrote in a way that, that evoked such emotion and conveyed the passion so many of us have for the game so powerfully. So he's a huge loss. You know, it's very sad, 68 years of age. You know, it's tough on his family, of course, and all those closest to him. He'll be deeply missed.
He will, Richie. And thank you for telling us about your memories of him. James, obviously now your West Country correspondent, Cheltenham is your patch. It was an incredibly important, special place to Alistair on personal and professional levels. Just last week, we were in here talking about how the press room was named after him. You were there. You would have seen how much it meant to him. I said on this panel last week, isn't it great how we can be honoured while he's still with us? And I'm sure he had a wonderful time, you know, catching up with old colleagues and a place that meant a lot to him.
Absolutely. And if anyone sees the clip the Racing Post socials put out where he talks about his favourite Gold Cup, which was Dawn Runs, you can still see that he really, what would turn out to be right up to the end, he still had that love, that enthusiasm, which he had really since he was a kid. He's in the conversation we were having, talking about his history in Cheltenham and his association, it was sort of an interest since he was about the age of five. So this is someone who's loved racing all the way through. Two really lovely, lovely tributes there. And I think I would add to that and say, what I think is particularly special about him, I agree with everything both of you said, is that racing and the emotions of the Cheltenham Festival are that is something like no other. It's a place where people are drawn to. They're obsessively drawn towards going to Cheltenham, spending a lot of money, diverting a lot of time to be there, getting time off work. People are drawn to Cheltenham like no other, and the emotions you get from that place in those 4 days, and three for a long time, are really off the scale. And for a lot of people, they struggle to describe how it feels. They can't really imagine what it's like and why they do it. And they try and tell someone who's not interested how they do it. Alistair was somebody who really summed up that emotion and really was the key part as when the Cheltenham emerged to this huge sporting central place. His writing was one of the key parts of how Cheltenham's evolved to become not just the big event in racing, but really in British sport society. The way he writes about Cheltenham, the poetry, the way he treats it almost as a pilgrimage, I think it really sums up and brings people exactly what they're feeling. It tells them what they're feeling. And that effect is very hard to do, especially with the written word. So he has a huge, huge credit. I mean, just some of the tributes, which I was speaking to people on Friday. Richie mentioned Henry Daly. Henry Daly was talking about the times they had together, some lots of laughs and some not so early mornings for Henry. He describes after their amusing nights in together. Nick Henson said he was totally unique and his gift was just amazing. One of a kind, said by AP McCoy on social media. And the one sort of tribute I think really stood out to me was from Ted Walsh, who came last Friday for his press room opening, who said he was one of those people you're lucky to meet and you'll never forget. And I think that's a really, really good way of summing up. And just finally, from my own experience of Alistair, there's two things I remember. Firstly, was the first time I met him was on King George Day, and he sat to me, I would have been in the Racing Post probably a year, no more than a year, and he sat down with me for about 2 or 3 minutes, and I always remember sort of what he was saying, and he was sort of aware of what I'd done, and it was a big pat on the back without being a pat on the back. It was quite subtly done, and as I look back a bit older, and maybe not so much wiser, but I look back and go, that was actually quite clever, because he knew that effect would have, and it was very personable, and it was quite encouraging to me and what was an early stage in my career. So I remember that conversation well. And then the other thing is that I do live in Cheltenham, and I think at times everyone in their career, they look back and they just, you have a bit of a downtime. I don't know, you had a bit of a stressful period and stuff. There are two things I do which gives me the buzz back. Number one is I go up to the race course and walk around it, and I'm just like, oh, how lucky am I to have this job? And the other one is there's a book of all Alistair's greatest works, Cheltenham et al, it's called. I read a couple of passages from that. That's two of the things I would always do, and it would give me the spark back. So credit to Alistair, a pleasure knowing him, a brilliant five-time winner of the Racing Writer Award, and just a one-of-a-kind, as AP McCall rightly said.
Thanks, James. Yeah, that really is beautiful. Worth saying, there's so much on the Racing Post site at the moment, so many of Alistair's great pieces on there, so make sure to read that. And in Sunday's paper as well, there was a 16-page commemorative pullout, so hopefully some of you got your hands on that. David Ashford's obituary in particular, if you don't shed a tear to that, then yeah, it's incredibly moving and beautifully done. So all of us here at the Racing Post are thinking of Alistair's family and friends, and may he rest in peace. The story dominating the racetracks last week was City of Troy's bid for a Breeders' Cup Classic. Well, as I mentioned at the start of the show, it all went up in smoke more or less as soon as the gates opened. It had been a narrative of the season that our great champion three-year-old, the Derby winner, was going over to America to take on their best on the dirt. It was a surface switch for the son of Justify. Would he handle it? I think the answer was a decisive no. Rishi, this is your story this week. I was quite surprised earlier when I was looking back through the results that he actually finished 8th of 14. I thought it was even worse than that, but they were strung out all over California, weren't they?
Yeah. Look, it was an awful anticlimax, ultimately. It was something, as you say, we have been building up to, not even all week, I suppose, you know, for a lot of the summer, this was on the horizon, and we knew it was on the agenda. And Aidan said early on, you know, that even the Irish Champion Stakes probably wouldn't be on the agenda because this was where they were looking, and that's very unusual. They felt, I suppose, that being by Justify, you know, that he was potentially the right horse to do it. And the way they campaigned him during the year, tactically, the way they pushed him forward and got him out there, you know, it all led to Del Mar. So it was a pity for it to end as abruptly as it did ultimately. You know, and it wasn't a surprise, let's be honest. You know, there were, you know, on our own kind of WhatsApp group the other night, there was a poll went up, two answers, eat them or eat dirt. You know, that's kind of what it was, you know, I think how a lot of people felt it might go. If he got the break and he got out and he was, you know, able to escape the dirt and travel in a good position from stall three, you know, you fancied he might go on and do the job. But if he didn't, he was always going to be up against it. People look at, I suppose, at the ultimate winner and they say, well, he was behind him, you know, for much of the race. But he's a horse who's used to racing on dirt. He's used to getting a face full of dirt, even though he actually ultimately raced wide. So they're very different scenarios. They're very different situations for the two horses involved. So it's frustrating. It's disappointing. You know, I mean, he's a very good horse. There was an awful lot on the line from, I guess. If he didn't win, you were looking at him probably as, you know, a very good Group 1 horse and maybe not an awful lot more. Obviously, the Coolmore team have been talking him up an awful lot. We know that. If he won, you were maybe looking at it and saying, well, they're probably right. You know, I mean, if he won a Classic, a Derby, a Judmont, an Eclipse, you know, he probably is the best they ever had. So there was an awful lot at stake on one race. That was, you know, the roll of the dice they had, and it didn't work out. So, yeah, disappointing to see it end the way it did the other night. He kept going. I mean, you say he finished 8, you thought he might have finished further back. I suppose it wasn't a vintage classic, and he ultimately just kept galloping away. The winner is a decent horse at that level without being exceptional. It was a classic without any of the Triple Crown winners in it. You know, so it was a good classic without being a great classic, I'd imagine, a good winner. The right horse finished second. It's good to see the Japanese horse run well in third. It just wasn't a beat for him. You know, he broke slowly. And it's a European thing. Even the Ballydoyle horses, you look at Henry Matisse, overcame a bad break on the turf. Lake Victoria didn't break superbly. She broke okay, kind of on par, and she got swallowed in a heartbeat as well. She had to overcome a really difficult passage from there. She got hampered and everything quite badly. So it's difficult then when you transfer to the dirt to try and break on a par with them dirt horses who are doing it week in, week out. You know, he was always up against it. And, you know, I watched the Southall gallop, and you were saying, like, he's up against inferior horses here. If he's going to be competitive in a classic, he has got to break quicker than them, and he's got to lead them, you know, at the gate for starters, whatever they do ultimately after that. But he didn't even break on a par with a few of those inferior horses at Southall. So you were always concerned, like, that he was going to be up against it from stall three. Had he been drawn wider, that situation might have been negated. He might have been able to avoid all the dirt and the kickback, but he was drawn in three, and once he didn't break, he was eating out with the dirt pretty much straight away, and he just didn't hit. He didn't obviously go on the surface, you know, either. I mean, it was a combination of those two things, I imagine. I don't think it's a fair reflection probably of his ability. I think it's fair to say he's a better horse than that, but, you know, it wasn't for him on Saturday.
It certainly wasn't. Aidan O'Brien, interestingly, blaming himself, saying it's my fault, you know, we didn't get him ready enough at the gates. I think I'm in agreement with you in that, yes, he didn't break well enough, but I wouldn't necessarily blame Aidan for that. I'm not sure what more they could have done. I'm sure they did more than just the Southall training at home. And I think he didn't handle the surface anyway. Do you think Aidan's right to blame himself?
Aidan will always do that. Like, that's his nature. He will always blame himself. I've been down there in Ballydoyle before Breeders' Cup. I think it was Churchill when they were trying to get him ready. And I heard the shrill of the gates, the bell on the gates and the banging. You know, they do everything they possibly can. But the American horses, it's like second nature to them. You know, they break so much faster. They're trained to break so much faster. Racing in Europe, it's a more even pace, a more even tempo. You know, they're quite happy to come back and take position. Whereas in America, they on the dirt, they have to go forward. You know, that's the style of racing. They go out, they go hard, and they keep going. And if you get caught in behind, you're in trouble. So the European horses that go over there are just not accustomed to it. There's only been one manage it in 40 years on dirt. I know Henry the Navigator managed it on the synthetic surface, but in 40-odd years, there's only been one manage it on dirt. And this is why, you know, they're not accustomed to that style of racing. And you look now at what James Causeway achieved 25 years ago, nearly at this stage, when he was just pipped by Tisno. And it was incredible, you know, and the magnitude of that effort kind of grows when you see a horse like Sibia Troy go over there and just get licked. You know, it's incredible that he so nearly pulled it off on that dramatic night under Mick Cannane. So yeah, what can Aidan O'Brien or anyone else do? I don't know. They have to be conditioned to do it, basically. You know, and it's not just the start; it's the surface as well. You know, because they don't get the same traction that they do on turf on that dirt surface. So they have to know how to operate on it. And, you know, he was exposed to it.
Would they have any sort of American-style gallop at Ballydoyle?
Not a dirt surface, I don't think. But they have all sorts of, you know, synthetic surfaces, grass surfaces, wood chip surfaces. But I don't think there's a dirt surface. Okay. Now, I might be wrong with that, but I don't believe there is.
Okay, maybe. I wonder if that's something they could look at if they want to try and give this a go in future. Finally, Richie, how do you think this will impact his stud career? Will it have any relevance? You know, obviously it's a huge race, and if he would have won it, then that would have transformed him in terms of, I'm sure he would have got lots more dirt mares as well. But for European breeders, is this going to make much difference?
I don't think so. I mean, he obviously has huge appeal anyway, and he will have, and he'll be pushed, of course. He's a Derby winner. He's a 10 furlong group winner twice and produced a fairly outstanding performance at York. Time will tell. You know, he's he'll fall in there, you know, into the Coolmore operation, and he'll get plenty of support and he'll get every chance. It's not easy to practice the stallion side of it. You know, we've seen Frankel and See the Stars in particular, and Dubawi do it in terms of the real cream over the last kind of 10 or 15 years. It's a big ask, but time will tell.
It will indeed. James, I obviously thought it was sad, but it didn't get pulled off. I was a believer in the end. Somehow I'm a cynic with all these horses trying new things, and short prices aren't for me, but I somehow thought, you know, he might just do it. I didn't think it was a particularly strong year, but I think it was fantastic that they tried, and I hope they keep trying things like this, because I think it's just great for the sport.
Absolutely, that's the one sort of takeaway I had. I think there's a lot of people on social media who, as soon as those gates went out and it seemed the writing was on the wall, they were quick to say, oh, I knew it was never going to work, and people sort of thinking, oh, I know a bit more than Aidan O'Brien, it was never going to happen, they shouldn't have bothered anyway. But actually, no, this is something to be applauded, because going and trying to beat the Americans on dirt is an extremely difficult thing to do, as Richie's really well elaborated there. And the ambition of it has really kept this flat season alive for a long way.
Definitely.
On. And I think as well, I mean, Aidan O'Brien, he became the winning most trainer at the Breeders' Cup on Friday with two winners. That's an extraordinary achievement, considering he's European, the differences of getting over, the challenges of getting runners, let alone having winners there. That was an incredible achievement. But there's something quite exciting about a trainer like Aidan O'Brien, who's achieved all these great things, still having that little itch to scratch, still thinking. I mean, he came away and said, oh, we'll try harder next year. You know, that's not what the Americans wanted to hear, was it? They were sort of, thankfully he's not trying to win dirt races. Oh, we'll try again, we'll try harder. It's not what the Americans would have wanted to hear, but it's interesting to sort of hear him speak about something kind of passionately, just like Willie Mullins talks about the Melbourne Cup, as we'll find out on Tuesday. Yeah, he didn't handle the surface. It was the fastest half mile in the classic history, which is interesting. So it was always going to be a tough ask for him, the way the race was going to pan out. Yeah, as Richie rightly says, those horses are just built and made from day one to smash the gates. And that's what we see at Royal Ascot, when sort of the gates open and the two-year-olds have passed away. Wesley Ward, you know. So we see the other side of what happens when a European horse goes over there. Yeah, it didn't happen. I think City of Troy will still have huge appeal as a stallion. You know, he has been talked up, and I think that what he achieved on the track, perhaps people will reflect on it differently, the fact he's gone to the Breeders' Cup and lost. I mean, he's won those Group 1 races, he's won them well, but they weren't Frankel-like performances that were going to draw people away or anything like that. It's a sad end to what could have been something glorious, but as you rightly say, so often these Derby winners, they're campaigned almost commercially. You know, which races can we run them in so that their stallion career looks good? And it's not about taking chances. It's not about taking risks. This was about taking a risk, and it was fantastic. And the one other thing I will say that I absolutely love from the Breeders' Cup is the Connections of Fierceness, who were just absolutely all in. They were calling for match races. He was on social media yesterday. I see posting saying we're going to win it next year. I mean, it's very American. It's very American, I have to say. But I love that bit of fighting spirit. And that rivalry going into it, you had three horses from three continents all going for it. I thought it was brilliant for the sport. And that's exactly what it thrives off.
Yeah, indeed. And even when Coolmore lose with City of Troy, they win with Sierra and Go. You just can't beat them, can you? The rest of the Breeders' Cup, well, we had some great performances, didn't we? Lake Victoria, who Richie mentioned earlier, was just absolutely spellbinding for me in the juvenile fillies turf. Starlust won the turf sprint. That was quite an incredible ride from Ross Orion. And then Rebel's Romance, it was a seventh group or grade one for him. James joined Conduit and High Chaparral as a dual winner of that race, of course regaining his crown from a previous year. Any other highlights, any other horses you want to mention?
Well, I think Rebel's Romance deserves a bit of credit. I mean, that's nine group one races. Absolute superstar of this horse for Godolphin.
That's nine. I only had seven.
Okay, maybe your maths is wrong. Mine's right.
We've discounted.
But whatever. Either way, absolute superstar. Won in UAE, Germany, America. It's just an incredible achievement what this horse has done. And for Godolphin to have, I think actually, won £9 million.
There we go. That's where the nines come from.
Yeah. but unfortunately, Emily Upjohn got an absolute nightmare run in. And JLB Heart attack was absolutely gutting for Brian Meehan. The only other comment I'd like to make, and I'm interested to hear what Richie said, is I read David Jennings' fine work out there, including when Colin Keane had a winner, and he said that a second winner at the Breeders' Cup, Colin Keane outstanding jockey and an American hack, he calls him, said, who is this Colin Keane? And I'd have loved to see DJ's reaction as when he won on Magnum Force for Gio Loins. So that was a really good performance as well. And I'd love to see DJ react when they said, who is Colin Keane, to David Jennings? Because he's quite the fan of Colin by the sounds of it.
Yeah, he's very unheralded, isn't he, Colin Keane? I'm sure not in Ireland, Richie.
No, look, he's a fantastic rider. He needs the exposure at the big stage. And Gio Loins knows that, and Colin Keane knows that. They need the ammunition. I remember speaking to Mick Kinnan a few years ago. About 5 years ago, I did an interview with Mick Kinnan, and we were just discussing the up-and-coming riders and who's going to make that step, you know, without your Fallons and so on. And he was one guy, he said he's got the talent, but, you know, he's in the comfort zone at the moment with Ger. Is he going to be willing to step outside it? So, you know, we're going to find out over the next year or two, I suppose. You'd imagine the offers will come in. Is he going to make that step up to the next level?
There was once chat that he could be Coolmore's next number one, wasn't there? Did you read much into that? Do you think that was just rumours? Or?
Yes, I wouldn't have read much into that. Just rumours. he rode a few for them the year, in one of the tight years, he rode a few for them, and people kind of threw legs out of that. No, there was never any substance as far as I was concerned. But he has enormous talent. As I said, when I spoke to Mick Kinnan about that a few years ago, you know, one of the other guys we spoke about was Oisin Murphy, and that he had it, and that he was comfortable putting himself out there, going abroad, looking for the big rides, putting himself on the big stage. We need to see that from Colin, that, you know, that progression. You know, he needs to go out and go on riding group ones in France and England and America, and put himself out there. And, you know, you would imagine the opportunities will be there for him. He's starting to be recognised and be, you know, accepted as a rider capable at this level. But we'd love to see him push on. They have to kind of want it and go for it and get out of the comfort zone and make the most of what they have. And he has a lot.
I think Ross Orion has a lot as well. As I say, that ride on Starlust was spectacular. It's been a fantastic year for him winning the ARC, and many more big victories await for him, I am sure. But before we do, check out our Racing Post Insider. Welcome back to this final instalment of The Front Page. And next, we're going to talk industry matters. James's story is going to be based on the budget that was announced on Wednesday by the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rachel Reeves. Broadly, bad news, I think it's fair to say, James. But the thought is it could have been an awful lot worse. How is it going to impact racing?
So there were mixed feelings after the first Labour budget in 15 years. Now, the good news is we feared there would be, or indeed racing feared, a major hike in general betting duty, which, given the pressures of affordability, given we've had a number of bookmakers boycotting because racing's not profitable, that was a big concern. But that was not part of the budget, which I think was a surprise to some. It's not completely over and done with. I mean, the Treasury spokesman has said the government will consult next year on that and look to close loopholes. But the BGC said any sort of duty rise would have impacted growth, risk jobs, and given the black market a bit more steam. Share prices of bookmakers went up after the budget, which is the clear sign that's good news for them. But, as you say, not all is rosy, because there were a number of big changes. I mean, the general wider context being that there's a black hole, a £20 billion black hole after the former government that Labour are looking to sort out. And one of them is impacting national insurance contributions of what employers have to pay. So essentially there are two things that are happening at once which will impact racing, as I'll get to. So essentially the salary threshold at which an employer has to pay their national insurance has dropped from a salary of 9,000, 1,000 to 5,000, while the rate of which go towards the government has risen from 13.8% to 15%. So that's going to bring about $25 billion into the economy, but that's going to impact employers, which are essentially trainers and racecourses. There's also a change to business rates. So the discount they get is going to be a lot less, which is again going to impact employers. And finally, the national living wage is going to jump up to £12.21 per hour, and for 18 to 20 year olds to £10 an hour. Now that will also affect racecourses in particular, because they have a lot of staff on those sort of low salaries. So those three things all at once are creating this really uncertain future for businesses. The National Trainers Federation, Paul Johnson, has said that many training businesses will be unable to sustain these cost increases, and is forecasting a drop of trainers, particularly those in rural areas, where it's particularly challenging to get staff in, and at the low end especially. The BHA's Director of Communications, Greg Swift, warned of significant damage. The BHA are aware of the pressures of this. They also called on government to urgently reform the levy and address the impact of affordability. And the RCA boss, David Armstrong, said it was a tough pill to swallow, and warned again on the employment impact of employment levels and prize money. So these three things coming at once are going to affect all businesses in Britain. This isn't just a racing issue, but those in particular are going to hurt. And that's the big issue going forward, because, again, we know the pressures on trainers, especially that smaller to mid-tier trainer. A lot of them are leaving. You know, it's hard to get owners in, prize money struggling, the rates and the cost of things are getting more expensive. And now the other thing they're going to have to pay more, essentially wages and taxing. That's just another expense when there's no real sign that prize money is going to go up to compensate that. And also, there's no sign of prize money going to go up because there's still this uncertainty as to what's happening with bookmakers. So there's this whole sort of uncertain world that you're looking at in a balance sheet. You're looking at next year going, right, well, we're going to be paying a lot more, and we're not in any way confident we're going to get getting more in. So it is uncertain times, and I do think that this is just only going to add to that pressure that trainers are experiencing, and I think it's inevitable that a few more will have to leave. It's just simply what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's a precarious environment, isn't it, at the moment for a lot of trainers. They're going to be forced to increase their fees on the back of this. That's obviously going to put owners under pressure in terms of horses that they have in training, particularly Absolutely. If they're, like you say, on the smaller side, or Yep. owner breeders as well. You speak to a lot of trainers regularly. You know the headwinds that they're facing already. We know that trainers are quitting left, right and centre on that smaller scale. How worried would you be with this budget announcement?
Well, it is extremely worrying, because there's less trainers about, which means there's less staff really going to be. If there's less yards, there's probably going to be less staff, unless others get bigger. And it's this whole sort of theme of the bigger getting bigger, the smaller just disappearing.
I was going to ask you about this.
That's what
yeah.
will happen, because people who own racehorses will still want to own racehorses. It's just where they go is different. And that's particularly in jumps, that's becoming more and more of a problem. Those big yards are still growing. You look at a sort of a yard like Fergal O'Brien or Dan Skelton, who in the last few years have really boomed. And, you know, for all there are still huge economic challenges, these are yards that are proving that if you have the right way of going about your business as a trainer, you can still be profitable, not necessarily profitable, but you can still be attractive and grow. You know, it's not a sign of everyone is shrinking. That's not what's happening at all. But as you rightly say, for all these changes I've just mentioned will have a knock-on effect to trainers themselves. They also have a bigger, wider effect. I mean, if people have got less disposable income, they're not going to go racing. They might not be having a bet, which all streams in to what's going to happen. Look, it is a budget. It's all predictions. It's all forecasted. They're never always 100% true. But it is worrying times, because, as I said, it's going to cost more and there's no guarantee of more coming in. So it's a testing time for the sport, which we've said in the front page studio many, many times.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is bad news on top of bad news, really. You talk about racecourses and how they're going to struggle. Well, we've got this ongoing media rights war at the moment. We've also got affordability. You know, are these changes going to push more people towards the black market? It's just problem after problem. Richie, I know obviously you're a little more detached from this one, but it doesn't spell great news for British racing, does it? It seems like it's just a very challenging environment if you're a stakeholder right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, it wouldn't have been a story I was across last week being off and so on. So, I wouldn't have an awful lot to say on it at this stage. But to echo what James is saying there, like anything that makes it harder for the smaller trend is not good for the game. You know, the tentacles of the game should be spread far and wide. You know, we need those smaller yards. The industry needs them. They provide jobs all over the country. You know, they when they're there and the market is strong and broad, you have a good trade and that's good for breeders and producers and all the rest of it. Anything that condenses it, where you get a smaller handful of much bigger stables, is not good for the game. And if this is going to make it particularly hard, by the sounds of it, these changes are going to make it particularly hard for the small operators, that's disappointing and that's worrying. So, yeah, I mean, you talk about the government policies, like, and they're trying to bring in extra revenue. If you're ultimately closing down businesses, you wonder about the wisdom of that sort of strategy. But this is the way they've laid it out. But yeah, like we've seen it here, and how difficult an environment it has become here in Ireland with a small handful of extremely powerful operators. Look, there are always a few punching away. We had Shane Broderick win the Cork National yesterday. That was great to see. Things like that, there was the results you want. But any kind of shrinkage of the base, I think, is not good for the game long term, because you don't want to be relying on such a small kind of coterie of powerful operators, in my opinion.
Indeed. As always with these stories, we will track them on the front page, so make sure to stay tuned for future episodes as we find out how racing begins to tackle, hopefully, some of these huge challenges. Now, it's come to the point in the show where I have to nominate the leading story, and of course it has to be the very, very sad passing of Alistair Downe. All of us have incredibly fond memories of a very, very special man and a very special writer. So all that remains to be said is, again, that our thoughts are with his family and friends, and his work will live on. And if you get 5 moments today, I would urge you to read some of his work, because it truly does remind us why we fell in love with this sport. Thanks to Richie and James for joining me on today's show, and we'll see you again in a week's time.